Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Wandering Road Podcast. I'm your host Chris, alongside my co-host Dean, and for today's show, we're going to be delving into a little bit of true crime. Our topic today is going to be the Eight Immortal Murders, or also known as the Chinese Pork Bun Murders. But joining us for today's show is Susie from the Susie Ideally YouTube channel. How are you doing today, Susie?
I'm good. I'm a bit nervous, but thanks for having me today.
No need to be nervous. It's just think of it as just you're just hanging out with a group of friends, having drinks and just talking about true crime and some weird decrepit shit that we're going to get into with this story.
Yeah.
But Dean, how are you doing today, buddy? Oh, absolutely. We all do, which is great. Yes, listeners, yeah. We're all kind of boozed up here. But Dean, how are you doing, buddy?
all three of our listeners to take off the pressure from Susie. Hi, Mom. I keep making that same joke. Yeah, I'm good, man. How about you?
I'm doing all right. I'm kind of excited for this one because I did not know this was a thing until I started messaging back and forth with Susie about potential topics. Specifically with true crime in Asia, I didn't know there was like a shit ton of them that, you know, you could look through and go through. And this one, you look at it and you just hear the title. It's like pork bun murders. It's like, what the hell does pork bun have to do with murders? And then when you look into it, it's one of those cases where it's like, the more you read it, it starts off like, okay, okay. And then when you get to the end, it's like, holy shit. Like,
yeah.
What? Like, this is disgusting. It's gruesome. And it's just one of those things. I'm just excited to both of your thoughts on this one. But Susie, why don't you introduce yourself to the audience a little bit? Why don't you tell us a little bit about your YouTube channel and your interest in true crime and that you might be potentially starting your own podcast?
Wow. So thanks for that introduction. And I do have a YouTube channel. I mean, I've had it since like 2010. I always posted very casually, and it's not a true crime channel. It's just kind of like it started out as like a lifestyle. Whenever I did anything interesting, I would vlog it and upload it. But that was like only once a year because my life is not that exciting. But fun fact is, but I've always wanted to be a YouTuber. I'm very fascinated by the whole influencer content creation route. But earlier last year, I actually had a baby. So I'm a new mom. And I was... Yeah. Thank you. I have a 7-month-old now. Thank you. And so I started posting kind of my experience, like shorts, as like a new mom of my baby. And people, I guess, finally, like, people discovered my channel that way. And it actually grew because I was on maternity leave. I was posting pretty consistently, and I actually made a YouTube partner last year. It's still a very small channel, but yeah, that was like a really big milestone in my YouTube career.
Can I ask you a question? You have a 7-month-old. How are you? And there they are. I was just going to say, how are you functioning right now? How are you awakened and able to think and process? Because I remember when I had my daughter, she's 3 now, my wife and I were like zombies for a while. So props to you for looking presentable and being able to put 2 sentences together.
Thank you for saying I look presentable. I tried really hard today. But I think that it's just important to have a system and obviously have a good and supportive partner. We both take turns sleeping. So our baby right now, he gets up about twice. And then I would take the first feeding, and then he takes the second. So we each get one long stretch of sleep, and we kind of have it figured out by now.
Yeah. Pay attention, Chris. This is exactly how it works.
Yes.
Oh, dude, I'm the light sleeper. So me and my wife already agreed that if the future baby wakes up whenever we have that baby, It'll probably be me waking up. So,
you know, that's actually what happened to me. I'm the same way. And for my wife and I, our deal in the beginning was like, okay, I'll get our daughter at night because I had more flexible hours at work.
Yeah, I think like trade off. There's no sense that you are both suffering at the same time. I think that is the how we do it. Like, yeah. we allocate, like, you handle it this time and then let me relax. And then, you know, so you each get your rest.
Exactly. And then make sure occasionally you pepper in there some really crass jokes about how, you know, what are you doing? You're supposed to be in the kitchen. Why aren't you holding the baby and making dinner? And then you get slaps from your wife and you start laughing. And then it's all fun and games until, you know, she beats you up.
No, yeah, he makes jokes. Like, he's just like, you're the mom, you should do it. But it's like a joke, but I know he really means it.
No, he doesn't mean it. No, we don't mean it when we say that. It's all a joke. No, that's great, though, that you have time to do this sort of thing in the YouTube channel. Your YouTube channel is kind of like starting to take off. That's really exciting.
Yeah, just be consistent. And plus, YouTube is really pushing shorts. And it's just so much easier to make than a long form channel. And as long as it's something that people resonate with. So I had two semi-viral videos. Each hit over 1 million views, but they're shorts. So that was really what helped brought my channel to partner level. And I had a goal to make partner at the end of the last year, and I was able to do it. So it was just really cool. And I'm trying to see, and now I'm trying to enter the podcast space, obviously. So yeah, I'm happy to be here today. Thank you for having me.
Oh, absolutely. We're happy to have you to discuss this topic today, because you were the one that actually suggested it.
Yeah. So I've always been a fan of true crime, which is weird because, you know, females tend to, I always found that females are most fascinated with true crime as compared to all my male friends. My husband hates it. So I don't really have anybody to talk to about this. So I'm glad I found you guys. Yeah, so I watch like pretty big YouTubers like Mr. Ballin, Bailey Sarian, and then another Korean YouTuber called Grazy TV. And so I've heard about this case growing up. Like, it's a pretty famous case in Hong Kong and China, and I'm Chinese, so I've heard of it, but I never really dug into it until like to prepare for this podcast. And it's exactly what you imagine. I find that crimes like committed by Asians, it's always a little really like out. It's really bizarre. They take it to the next level as compared to what you hear about from like American crimes and American serial killers, I feel like. And this case really embodies that.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because we were talking offline before we started a little bit, and you kind of sparked my memory again about that. So like, there is this really incredible perspective about Asian crimes that happen in Asian countries. And sometimes, like you said, they're just so out there. They're just like so intense, or it's like, how in the world, and we're going to talk about this today, but like, how in the world can someone go systematically like slit the throats of a family or something like that? And that's just something you don't really hear about happening in America. Like, you hear like terrible things like gun violence, like mass death that way, but it's much less personal. With guns and stuff, it's like you're from a distance and you're taking someone's life. You're not really up close and personal. But like, some of these stories coming out of Asia, like, I remember there was this one, and I'm probably going to get the details drastically wrong, but I think there was this Japanese girl, or I think it was actually a boy, maybe, something about like, he felt dishonored by being bullied at school or something like that. And he went in at home and he killed his grandparents because of that feeling of dishonor. Which is very, you know, kind of like counter to what you would probably expect in America. Like, if someone like felt slighted in America, they would go after the person slighting them or their family. But in this case, it was like, oh, I, I don't have, like, I just feel inadequate. I have to take myself out of the equation and have to take my family out as well, because they're going to be shamed. I don't want to feel them, you know, see them be shamed or whatever. So it's just like, I guess it's just kind of like a different cultural perspective. Just a quick story. When I went to Japan for the first time, I think 4 or 5 months ago, and it was a beautiful, amazing trip. Like, love Japan, nothing but the sweetest, nicest people I've ever met in my life. But when I was going over there on the plane, I'm like, maybe I'll be responsible since I'm traveling with my family. Let's see what's in the news over there. And like one of the first news channels or the news articles that I was looking into was some monk who owned a monastery, or not monastery, but like a, I don't know what you would call it, like a little temple or something in Tokyo. He was targeted by two guys, I guess, who wanted his land. And they set up this like really elaborate situation where they put a bunch of gasoline open in these burn chambers for bodies or whatever, like underneath the ground, underneath the temple. And they opened up all the plugs from the containers. And they knew that this guy who would go down there to like do whatever they do down there in the chamber, he ended up asphyxiating and dying because he didn't know that all those fumes were down there. Turned out it was like this big murder case about these two guys who were trying to get this monk to like cede the land to them. And they ended up killing him to try to get those rights somehow. But it's just like, I was on my way to Japan hearing that story. I'm like, what is happening in Japan? And then there was another story that was right after that about how there were like bears attacking random people throughout cities in Japan. I'm like, what the fuck is happening? It is so strange. Anyway, I go off on a tangent there, but yeah, like just like we were saying, Asian countries tend to have like really intense stories about death and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think it's just that I feel like Asians in general, they really care about their image and their face. And they're usually more like, you would think, more submissive. We have a more submissive, that's how we are perceived. And then, but then when we snap, then we do crazy shit. And that's why, that's how you get these like crazy murders of like killing a whole family and cannibalism and all these crazy things.
And I kind of have a theory for that. And the reason I think that is because when you look at Asia as a whole, and I'll include like India in there as well, it's a very structured culture that has not changed for over like 5,000 years. And what you don't really do is deviate from what's expected and deviate from the norm. And you know, we're all human beings. Like, you can only take so much, and then you get to your breaking point. And I think that's why in certain places, like the case we're about to talk about today, is like why it's so gruesome. It's because of that. It's like, okay, my backlash is going to be so massive and so severe that everyone has to feel it.
Yeah.
It's not like moment. Just, yeah, it's like the ultimate fuck you moment to like this entire society.
Yeah, because we tend to bottle things up. But not this guy that we're about to talk about. He killed before, but then he got triggered again and killed even worse. So
I think it's a good opportunity to talk about, like, let's focus for a second about the location this happened in. So if you're not familiar with the geography of China and stuff like that, Macau is in the southeast portion of China. It's actually a stone's throw away from Hong Kong, but it's considered, I don't know if it's like the gambling capital of the world per se, but I think one of the metrics I read was the total annual revenue in Macau is like 7 or 8 times larger than Las Vegas in terms of gambling. So there's a ton of gambling. There's a ton of money in Macau. I think that's where they do like the Formula One races. So there's just like, it's kind of like Singapore light in my mind, like crazy rich Asian level. But like when I think of a place like this, there's just so much money focused on this one area. And it's not just money. There is chance and opportunity to gain and become rich from that big pile of money that exists there, which isn't the same from across the globe. Like, you can't just go, like, some places just don't have gambling. Like, they don't just have a lot of avenues to get really rich really fast. But Macau is one of those places where it's kind of like say the stock market, where you can go, like, people nowadays, there's an obsession with like 0 days to expiration trading, like all kinds of this crazy gambling stuff where you can just throw all your money in one go and you can really strike it rich. Like you could literally make enough money in a second to retire, but more likely than not, you're going to lose everything. So I like to think about it from that psychological perspective with this family and everything that happened with the Eight Immortals restaurant. It's like you have the mom and the dad who are addicted to gambling. And we'll go into more detail about this, but just to set up the situation, you have a mom and a dad who own the shop, the restaurant, they have a family, but they're also very admired or like just kind of down into that, into the weeds of that gambling that's going on in Macau. And clearly what, like they're driven by becoming wealthy. They don't want to do what they're doing anymore for the rest of their lives. They want to have that nest egg or that ability to break free financially. Kind of like you want to do what like people want to do with YouTube or being a podcaster
or podcasting.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. So totally understand. But, you know, when you get that kind of money and you feel this is a situation where, like, we've all been there. Like, I've been there. Like, I dabble in the stock market. There have been times where, like, I had, like, loss after loss after loss. And I'm like, God, like, why? You kind of, you know that there's nothing higher above you that is, like, slighting you. But you also kind of have that thing in the back of your mind. You're like, why is this happening to me?
No, just for and you, I, there is.
Just
there
for,
is.
Yeah.
Just for I you. Just he's like, ah, just, fuck you.
Fuck you, Dean. So I think it's the same way psychologically, probably even worse though, for this family who they have a good, like they have a decent life, they have their own business, but they're not breaking free anytime soon. And they really want to break free. So where the story really all starts, and we'll, like I said, we'll go back a little bit and set it up a little bit more, but where it all starts is this infatuation with making a lot of money quickly. And you have the person who killed them, the people who were the victims, they're all centered around this concept of trying to get rich quickly. And what do you do when you mix money with this feeling of feeling inadequate, like you were saying, Susie, and then also like feeling like you're being slighted or the universe isn't giving you, paying you your dues, even though you've been trying so hard, then you really start to get this like carnal hatred that builds up between people. I don't know, Susie or Chris, do you want to like talk a little bit about the background leading into this whole situation, like the family and the restaurant and stuff?
Yeah, so I'll kick us off. I apologize if I butcher his name. It's Huang Ji Heng or Hong.
It's pretty close.
Huang Ji Heng.
Okay. Sorry, I'm gonna ask Dean, are you partially Chinese?
Do I look? No, I'm just kidding.
I don't know. I'm sorry.
I'm just kidding. I'm not. I'm full white boy.
Okay.
But I did take Mandarin in college, so that's why I do have a little bit of an understanding of pronunciation.
Got it. Cool. All right.
Yeah, I'm a historian, so I just try to be as close to the pronunciation as possible. And he corrects me whenever I'm wrong. So I'm appreciative of that. So don't feel bad to correct me. So Huang, our buddy Huang here, he was originally from mainland China and he immigrated to Hong Kong in the 70s. So before he ended up murdering all of these people, this entire family, 10 of them, he was a gambler himself. So when he's in Hong Kong, he gets into gambling. He gets into a dispute with a guy. He ends up killing him. And then after he kills him in Hong Kong, he flees to Guangzhou, which is in southern China. And he lives in Guangzhou for a few years. I guess he found a place to live and he got close with the landlord's daughter. And the family didn't like him very much. They're like, this dude is weird. Like, he's into gambling. He's really creepy.
With good reason.
Yeah. We don't. There's something off about him. But the daughter was like, screw you guys. I like him. So they elope. And then they end up leaving mainland China to go to Macau. And before he does that, this is what this psychopath does. To make sure he is not connected to that murder in Hong Kong at all, he burned off his own finger, like fingerprints, and he cut off the tip of his index fingers to make sure he couldn't be tied to any type of nefarious activity or murders in Hong Kong. So then he goes to Macau And that's when he meets his victims, Zheng Lin and his wife, who were also heavy gamblers. And they were the owners of the Eight Immortals restaurant. Hence why we get the name the Eight Immortals Murder. But I'll kick it over to you, Susie. You want to pick it up from there?
Yeah. So Eight Immortal Murders, if anyone is curious, in Chinese, it's Bat Xin Fan Ding. So literally translates to Eight Immortal Murders. And there's very little known about Huang's childhood. So as I was doing research, many places, many sources said there's nothing really about his childhood, just that, you know, he was caught up in a lot of illegal activities. So when he moved to Macau, he got caught up in the gambling scene and he met Zheng Lin and his wife, who are heavy gamblers. They actually ran a very successful restaurant. They started off as a food stall in the 60s, and then due to the success, they turned into a restaurant. And it was so successful, they had their whole family, which is a total of 10 people, helping to run and operate the restaurant. But unfortunately, even though it was a very successful restaurant, they couldn't escape their gambling problems. And they were also not really good gamblers and would constantly and regularly lose money. And that was when they met Huang. They came across each other and they started actually befriending each other. They would hang out. They would gamble together. And then one day they got involved in high stakes betting. And the Zheng family, the Zheng couple, they lost about $20,000 to Huang. And that's a lot of money. And keep in mind, this was the 80s. And if I lost $20,000 now, I'm going to, you know, I'm going to poop my pants. So imagine losing that in the 80s. And obviously, they couldn't pay it back. So they reached an agreement. Huang said that, all right, if you cannot pay it back within 1 year, you got to give up your restaurant. And honestly, I find that to be very reasonable. For a, like, he's a murderer. So I found that really reasonable. I'm like, okay, yeah. Like, when you lose your gambling debts, you have to pay it. And so they came to that agreement. And then 1 year passed. And then during that year, they didn't stop gambling. They kept on gambling. And then in total, the Zheng family lost $75,000 in gambling debts to Huang. And that's where. This was now in 1986. And I'm going to pass it off to Dean if you want to pick it up from there. What happened after that year?
Popcorn, Dean.
Yeah, I'm popcorn.
You guys remember that? Oh my yes. God. Anyway, so yeah, so essentially after that, things started to get really heated, right? So Zheng Lin and his wife, they essentially didn't want to pay him back. They, I don't know. I can't even imagine what would be going through their minds right now. Like you said, like, you know, they must know that, I mean, they're not the best people in the world, because like, if they're going to shirk on a bet like that, and they made a promise and they continue to, if they really did continue to lose money to this guy, that's kind of shitty. I mean, I'm not saying they deserve to die, but like at the same time, it's kind of like they were kind of asking for trouble in a way, especially since they didn't really know who this guy was. Even if you, like, let's say hypothetically they knew him for even like 2 years, which is probably around the time that they really got to know him. That's not a lot of time to know somebody, especially if they came from another part of the country that you didn't really have any connections to or really know anything about. So this guy, Huang, who ended up killing these people, he just got pissed off. He's like, you know, you owe me money. You promised me to get, you know, to hand over the restaurant if you couldn't pay it back. I'm here to collect my dues. And of course, they didn't want to pay him back. They said, you know, of course, we're not going to do that. So at that point, I imagine Huang would just get really upset. He probably has financial responsibilities himself. Maybe he has some gambling owes to other people, but he is not quite rich just like they are, but he has an opportunity to take a step up and they're blocking him from doing that. So he feels slighted and he wants to take action. So he ends up grabbing a bottle, right, and smashing the bottle against a table. And he starts to threaten the family, like, you know, give everything to me, like, blah, blah, blah. And he grabs, I think it was the youngest, or not the youngest, but one of the, was his it the son. Daughter? Oh, his son, sorry. He grabbed
the son,
okay.
The only son first.
He grabbed the only son first. Okay. Yeah, started to threaten the family, like, hey, you better give me what I'm due, or I'm going to start cutting your son. From that point on, there was a lot of panic in the room, I imagine, and people really on edge. But I think it was the daughter tried to make a break for it, right? Wasn't the daughter tried to run away?
Yep.
Yeah.
And Huang just instinctively let go of the son and grabbed this girl. And I imagine like he was just gone at that point. He was just like tunnel vision. He ends up like cutting her throat, stabbing her or whatever, like slicing into her. And she's not quite dead yet, apparently, according to some accounts. She falls to the ground and she's bleeding out. And then he realized, I imagine this is the point where Huang realizes like, I'm done. Like this, I can't do this again. I killed somebody in Hong Kong. I got away from that. The only chance I have now is to get rid of all of the evidence. And the worst part of the story, you know, trigger warning for everybody. He decides that the only way in that moment to potentially fix his solution or his problem, the solution is to kill systematically the entire family. So he starts, you know, he tells the family to start tying each other up and gets them all bound and gagged, presumably. And then he systematically goes through and starts to kill every single one of them. And I just want to emphasize again, like, this is like, we're not here to glorify this or like talk about this moment as like, oh, edgy and exciting. This is really shitty, terrible stuff. And it's just a part of the story that has to be told. But, you know, the kids were young, and which is, I'm sure you, Susie, like, you know, you're a mother, I'm a father. Like, I fucking hate talking about this stuff now. Like, when I was younger and I didn't have any kids, I could talk about this stuff all day and feel nothing or not, you know, like not feel like I would feel like bad, but I wouldn't feel like close to home. But now it's like, I can't talk about this.
That
stuff
is because true. Ever since I became a mom, like I just get more scared hearing about these things. Like there's so much bad people out there. Gotta protect your.
Now you understand. You understand your parents.
Yes. He's never leaving. He's never leaving the home.
Hooking real. Yeah. So, I mean, if you're out there and if you don't have any kids, like I always kind of like snicker a little bit when I hear someone say, oh, I fucking hate kids. And it's like, yeah, well, have you ever taken care of them? Have you ever been around them when they're young and like seen how they need people and like realizing you were once that young and like all of those things that go along with being presented. And that's why, like, to me, when I hear stories like this, it's particularly disturbing because that means this guy was completely disassociated from the idea of innocence of a child. And whenever you have somebody like that, I feel like that is like, you can't always know a person's like that before you get to know them. Really. It's always after the fact. But like, if you were to know that a person was like that, you would probably want to stay far away from them because anybody who doesn't have like a closeness or a reflection or affinity for children who are not theirs, then that's kind of like a little bit in my mind, a red flag. So I guess that's the type of person this guy was. He went around and he ended up killing even all the way down to the youngest son, who was, I think, only 7, but the other kids were 9 and 10 and 12. And it's like, God, man, like that's just, no kid should ever have to go through anything close like that. And especially the parents who probably, I don't even know who died first, but like, that's even worse to have, you know, presumably have the parents be around for that. If it was me, I would break my arms, like trying to get out of, like, I would probably kill myself trying to get out like a wild animal. So I can't imagine they would probably go through the same thing. But so let's kind of like get away from that part of the terrible part of the story and move on to the next part, which is,
hey, you know, Dean, I wanted to touch on his mentality for a second, which you were kind of alluding to in general. Okay. So before he actually commits the murders, and I just, you know, it's impossible for us to know exactly what he was thinking. Clearly he's killed people before. Like, we know he killed at least one person. We don't know if he actually killed other people prior to this. So my whole thing is, when he breaks the bottle and he like threatens the family, I can't help but wonder, like, is this just a ploy to just get them to hand over the paperwork? And everything kind of just went wrong from there. Like, his whole plan just backfired.
Yeah.
Because I always wonder if his intention was to go. It's like, you know what? They're not paying me my money. They said they'd give me the paperwork for the restaurant. I'm going to go and kill all of them. Or do y'all think it was one of those cases where, like, oh, shit, this kind of went wrong, and that's not what it was like I intended?
I feel like he did not go in with the intention of killing them. He just wanted his money back because they were arguing for a while, and he was willing to negotiate with them. He was like, just give me 30,000 pukata, I believe that's the currency, and they won't give it. And then he was even willing to come down to, all right, just give me 20,000. And they won't do it, which I think is like, why at that point? Like, you have to have that as a small business owner lying around. Why are you refusing to pay like compromise there? So like, I don't really feel as bad for the parents. I only feel bad for the kids that were involved, like their family. So like, if you like, you put yourself in that situation, then you kind of have it coming for you. Of course, nobody deserves to like die in that manner, but that's what happens when you get yourself involved in bad situations like that. It just so happens that he came at a time when their whole family was there, and that was the tragic part.
I don't know if you guys have seen this movie, but it's like from 1994. It's a Chinese movie called To Live, and essentially, have you seen it, Dean?
I read the book. It's a great book.
It's a really good book, and it's a really good movie. So it takes place, I think it like starts in 1940. So it's like during World War II, and then it goes through like the Mao era with the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution. So the whole premise of the story is that this guy, he is a gambler, and he just goes to the gambling den all the time. And eventually at a certain point, he loses everything. But then at like the end of the movie, I can't remember if the book was the same thing, Dean, but he kind of like gets his shit together and everything is just happy, hunky dory. He like tries to be a soldier, and then everything turns out well. I just couldn't help but think about that movie of, you know, this family man that's like running a business. And then due to his gambling, similar to the movie, he just ends up losing everything. Unfortunately, he lost more than just everything. He lost his family. He lost his life. Dude, like even his like parents were killed. Like it just went out of control. But Susie, if you have not seen that movie, it's called To Live, and it came out in 1994. It's actually really good.
There's obviously a movie made about this specific case. I think it was from 93 or 94 also. And it's called The Untold Story.
Susie, I don't know if you will find this funny or not, but so my wife, I've said this on the podcast before, my wife is actually, like, her family is from Vietnam, but she came over here when she was, I think 3 years old. So she's like completely Americanized. Like, she doesn't, like, her parents still have a heavy accent and stuff, but she still has a very close tie to her culture. And like, she gives me shit all the time for not being more tied into or exposed to Asian culture, which I'm totally receptive to. But it's just kind of like, it's funny, like one little anecdote that I'll share. We were talking about, we were just talking about movies and stuff like that. And like it was kind of funny how To Live in my mind is a really well-known part of like the Asian diaspora in terms of like a really famous movie and a really great book and stuff. And like, Susie, you never heard of it, which is totally fine. But it reminded me about this time where, like, this actually just happened like 2 years ago, or maybe it was like a year and a half ago. I knew of the Joy Luck Club. Like, I knew about the story. But when I told my wife like last year, I'm like, I've never seen the Joy Luck Club. She lost her shit. She's like, how have you never seen the Joy Luck Club? It is such a huge staple of like culture, not just Asian culture, but like, you know, like it was American cinema. So she made me watch it, and it was a great movie. But until I watched that movie, I actually thought the Joy Luck Club was about a group of older Asian people who were in America who became really rich because they pulled their money together and like put it in the stock market or something. I don't know why I thought that, but that is completely opposite of what the actual story is about. But anyway, sorry to go off on a tangent. I just wanted to share that little nugget of randomness.
I don't actually know anything about the Joy Luck Club, so don't feel bad.
What?
Yes. No, I know way. A lot about Asian true crime, but not.
No, that's totally cool. It's once again, like, you know, it's a really good movie, and it's one of those movies where it really showcases like the challenges of older Asians coming over to America, but also it highlights the darkness that can like stick around. Like just like the guy who traveled from Hong Kong to be the killer of this family, like he had a dark past as well. In that movie, it's kind of similar. You know, they come over and they do flashbacks throughout the movie about like the youth of these women who come over from China. And like some of them had really dark experiences, like they were beaten or they were abused or neglected, or maybe like I think one of them like killed a child, like their own child or something like that, because she hated the husband who ignored her, and he was a womanizer, and she ended up like in anger drowning their child or something like that. And just this concept, like we were talking about earlier, there's like a lot of darkness that can come out of these stories from Asian culture that is like, you know, it's really one of those things where it's like you don't think about it until it happens, but then you, like Chris, you said, you reflect on the culture and you're like, oh, I can kind of see how that comes about. But I guess we'll jump back into the story. And like, I don't know if you, Susie or Chris, if you want to keep us going along here, but the next part is essentially, let's pick it up from where he tries to clean up his mess. The Huang guy, he tries to clean up the mess of this murder, the terrible murder he did of this entire family. And I imagine it must be a huge fucking mess.
I'll kick it over to our guests. I'm sure our listeners are tired of hearing both of our voices every episode.
Right. So this was August 4th, 1985. So that's a date. So this all happened. He visited the restaurant as they were closing and cleaning up for the next day. So the restaurant was closed. So he spent the whole night cleaning up his mess, you know, using like a knife, probably a butcher knife, hacking off their body parts and disposing of it. And the weirdest part of this story is that like afterwards, he cleaned it up, put it all in bags, dispose of it probably at the nearby beach. He went to their home and slept there because they lived very close by. And I'm just like, wow, like this guy is like not really right in the head, because you kill the family and then you go to their house and sleep there. So it's kind of like adding insult to injury. So he went to their home. He took all the money that they can find. He found the documents like of the restaurants to the restaurant. So he got what he wanted, which was basically his money back and ownership of his restaurant. It was the next morning that the delivery driver who normally delivers the food for the restaurant, he saw a sign outside that said that the restaurant will be closed for the next 3 days. Which to him it rang some bells, because he didn't hear about this and he delivers food to the restaurants every morning. So like, why wouldn't the Zhang family tell him about it? And he actually took the liberty to knock on the door of their family, of their home. And then that was when Huang answered the door and said that the family had to make an emergency trip to mainland China. And then I guess at that point, it wasn't so weird yet, because everybody knew that he was friends with them. He was associated with the Zhang family. So he just let it go. I guess for the next 3 days, he just laid low while disposing, cleaning up the mess. And then the other weird part is 3 days later, he opened the restaurant and ran it like normal. It's like as if there was no one's going to suspect a thing. They wouldn't notice that a whole family is missing, and he's just going to continue to operate their restaurant.
So what's insane, it was like 4 days later, a swimmer on the beach, he found 8 pieces of human limbs, including 4 right hands. And they suspected that it was smugglers involved with like sharks or something like that. They thought it was like, you know, people like trying to smuggle shit over, or somebody got eaten by a shark. But when the police investigated, they found that the limbs were actually severed with a blade. And that's what prompted their investigation. They kind of put two and two together, like, okay, this family's missing. We have these limbs. That's when the delivery guy becomes like the main key witness here, because he was the last, aside from Huang, who actually murdered them, the delivery guy was the last person to see them alive and well. Essentially what happens, like Susie said, the dude's running the restaurant like normal. In one of the videos that I saw, they claimed that he actually rented out their home.
Yeah.
Which was fucking wild to me.
Can I add something real quick? So this,
sure.
The more I hear this story, and this is just like my investigatory part of my brain firing, but like, think about this. So we have this story, and like you were saying, Susie, like I totally agree with you, by the way, when you were saying that like the mom and the dad deserved what they got because they were playing with fire and all that stuff. But here's an intriguing thing to consider. All of the information we have about how things truly played out probably came from Huang. You know, he was the only one there left alive after he killed everyone. So therefore, he was the only one to give the account of how things played out there. And then also, he was probably the only one to give an account of the family's, the mom and the dad's demeanor and like how they didn't give him the money that he deserved and all that. Like the way things played out, I'm gonna venture a guess and say that 50%, if not more of that, is fabricated, like completely fabricated. And that leads me to, like, when I hear parts of, and the reason I bring it up is because when I hear parts of the story, like he rented out the house, he went there to stay at the house afterwards, like all that stuff, I think that based off of that behavior, he was probably more homicidal than he led on to believe. I think he was probably trying to save a little bit of face and maybe reduce his sentence or whatever he thought he would get out of it by saying like, oh, I gave them a chance. Like, you know, I said, just give me 30,000 or give me 70 or 50,000, then 30,000, whatever. But he's really the only one who was there at that time. And he's also the only one who can give an account of how people died. So he knew that he was the only person who could be held responsible for their deaths. So he had to admit that he killed them. But I think it's fascinating that he had the opportunity to say things like, oh, there was a scuffle, or oh, like he tried to kill me first or something like that. No, but like the thing that came out, maybe he did try to do that, but the police knew better than that to kind of like give the right account. But just the fact that, like you were saying, Chris, he went back and rented the house afterwards, and he opened the shop up again and to make things look business as usual. To me, that kind of spells out premeditation. So I wouldn't be surprised if this dude already had in his mind, like, if they don't give me what I want, I am going to kill people tonight.
That's interesting.
Just my perspective. Yeah, that's just my perspective.
Did not think about that at all when I was looking into the case.
Yeah, and what also helped the police was that the family was reported missing by relatives as well. So that kind of helped them lead them to Huang himself, because it's like, okay, these people are missing. Their relatives are saying they're missing. And we got this weird motherfucker running their restaurant. We got random people living in their home collecting rent. And I'm not trying to make fun light of it, but I laugh because of the audacity of these fucking people. Like, if you look at true crime in general, like, Dean, we talked about the Kobe cannibal. Mm-hmm. Like, this dude, like, fucking ate this girl like it was nothing. And he had the audacity to go and live his life and pretend that never fucking happened. Eventually, it caught up to him because of, like, nightmares, and, like, he ended up regretting what he did. But I just can't help but, you know, you try to get into the psychology of these people, like, what the hell is going on in your mind? Like, are you missing that piece of humanity where you lack empathy, or you lack the ability of foresight? And when you could calculate, okay, if I do this, this is probably going to be the outcome. It's probably not going to end well for me. There has to be something missing up there.
And, you know, we've talked about this during other podcasts as well, when it comes to like the Judeo-Christian argument about how, like, oh, there's, you know, there are demons or whatever, like influence or like possession, like that comes into play during certain cultures and certain times. But in this case, it does not apply, because, you know, I mean, you could argue, like, depending on what their religion, they're Buddhist or something, or I guess there are some evil deities in religions like that. But at the same time, it's kind of like, now, I mean, I know this is a true crime documentary, but I had to just bring that up because it kind of ties into your your psychological concept about what these people were thinking of. And when I think of people who are like this, you're absolutely right. It's like there must be something missing in their empathy circuit, or like something that just doesn't click. Because I personally, not to sound like a complete wet noodle, but like if I do something shitty out of like anger, or like maybe I raise my voice or something, I'll feel like a pile of shit the next day. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like I just like, yep. It's just, you can't escape that empathy for other people. Even if you in that moment, like I could see in this moment, if this guy lost his shit, because like we were saying, that's a lot of money. There's a lot on the line for your life and the value of your life and like quality and all that stuff. So I guess, I mean, I'm not saying that it's okay what he did, but I can at least somewhat understand. Like we've all been out to the bar and we've probably seen that idiot who's too drunk fly off the handle and start swinging fists at people. In that moment, like, you know, that person really is losing themselves to their anger. But afterwards, like after this guy killed people, it's kind of like, how do you live with yourself after that? Like, I can't even imagine.
I mean,
sorry, go ahead, Susie.
My theory is they're definitely wired a little differently. And it's gotta be, for me, I think it is nature in that case, like serial killers, because if you think about it, can you think about a scenario where you would kill a family of 10? Like, what would drive you to do that? I don't think, hopefully, nothing would drive you guys to kill a family of 10, including 6 years old, someone as young as 6 years old. So there's no way that we are wired the same way.
No. I mean, that's adults, yeah, I'd fucking fuck some people up. Like, if you're trying to hurt my family, yeah. That's where, like, you know what's funny? I talked with my cousin about this, and we had this conversation because we talked about, like, serial killers, and we were just having this philosophical discussion. And the question came up is, like, what would be your driver to kill another human being? And we both came to the consensus that if our wives or future children, or like anyone in our immediate family was in some sort of mortal danger, even though I wouldn't want to, I think in that situation, either this person goes or they go or I go. And I'm going to choose my family and my life over some random bastard I don't know.
Now here, sorry to interrupt, but here's an interesting perspective that you can also apply to this dude's life or similar people. This person, this guy, Huang, operated in a normal capacity for most of his life, right? However, he might have been justifying things the same way you just did, in the sense that my quality of life and my wife and everything that I hold dear in my life is receptive upon getting this money from these people, or I'm going to, you know, see what I'm saying? Like, I'm not saying it's justifiable, because it's not a life for a life. Like in your case, it's like, I need to take this person's life because they're literally threatening the life of my loved ones.
Right.
But the person who might be disassociated, like Huang, he might be seeing money as equal to give, because think about like, if maybe he grew up in the worst shitty scenario that you could possibly imagine. Like there are people out there who don't have two dimes to rub together, and they really truly know what it means to struggle in life. So if they had something like money that would separate them from that life again, have that be threatened, that would probably be equivalent to someone threatening their actual life itself. Now, I'm not saying that that's what this guy Huang was thinking. If anything, I think he probably wasn't thinking like he probably had enough money. He probably had a decent amount of income to live a comfortable life. He was just being an asshole. But I just wanted to throw that out there, that it's not always cut and dry in terms of what people might be thinking psychologically to justify things. Cause I always go back to the idea that this is what I'll throw back to you, Chris, and even Susie, you can answer to this too, if you wanted, but like, if you had to kill somebody in defense of your family, in that moment, you would feel like it's justified and you would feel okay doing it. But what about after? And this goes back to the same concept of like going to war, like fighting for your country, you know, killing people in the line of duty or whatever. Like you are going to try to do that because you need to get home to your family. You need to provide for them. And you know that in that moment. So you're acting in an instinctive fashion. But after you take that life and you have a moment to reflect, like that psychological part of you, like that we're blessed with, like reflection and self-awareness, like that is the part that always blows my mind when someone acts in this fashion. They take a life and they're like they're a serial killer, or they act like this Huang guy, take the lives of a, like life of a whole family, including young kids. Like I couldn't imagine carrying that burden of reflection afterwards. So how do you think you would react in a situation like where you had to take someone's life in defense? Like, do you think you would be able to justify that continuously through your life?
I would use a specific example from what I saw about, I think this guy was part of SEAL Team 6. And he said that when they went to do the operation to, I don't know if it was the operation to kill bin Laden or if it was another operation. It might have been to take out another high-ranking member. He says he remembers going into this compound and they kicked down the door to the room. The guy's laying in bed with his wife. They're sleeping and he just pops like two bullets in him. And as he's sitting there doing the podcast, he's reflecting. He's about to cry. He's like, dude, this is with me every day because I always think back to that moment. I killed this man in front of his wife. She has no understanding of what the hell is going on. He's like, I don't know who that guy is. He could have been someone I had drinks with at a bar had circumstances been different. And then I think back to, I don't know if you guys have read the Iliad, but yes, I always have to throw in a little bit of history and classics in there and ancient Greece. That's kind of my thing.
But, nerd.
Yes. But thinking back to the Iliad, when Achilles kills Hector because Hector kills Patroclus, who was like Achilles's like lover or like best friend or whatever. At the end of it, like he weeps for Hector and he gives the body back to Priam, who sneaks into the encampment of the Greeks to plead for his son's body. And he gives it back and he cries for Hector because he has that remorse, even though he like recognizes he's this like, you know, this machine of a killer. There's still that aspect of humanity to him, realizing that I just killed someone's son. I just killed someone's husband, someone's father to that point. And when you look back at people like Huang and like Jeffrey Dahmer and John Wayne Gacy and all of these crazy people, or Issei Sagawa. Oh, geez. What are some other crazy cases? You have like the Hello Kitty murders. You have
Ted Bundy.
The guys.
The Night Stalker. The Night Stalker was a good example.
Richard Ramirez. Yeah. They don't have that self-reflection. They don't think what they did was wrong. They're just so numb to it. So that's my take on it. What's your take on it, Susie?
Yeah. Like I said, they're just wired differently. And a lot of times when I kind of listen to stories about these serial killers, they probably had a pretty messed up upbringing. Where it probably numbed that part of their brain, which actually would counter what I said earlier that it's nature versus nurture. But I think it kind of they both contributes to it. But yeah, I just can't think of a scenario where I would be able to kill people, a whole family, and then go sleep at their house right away.
And I just think of time, like you were saying, Susie, like you can't imagine killing someone and like living with yourself afterwards. It's kind of like similar based off of like not just your environment of how you grew up, but also all the other factors that play into like your DNA and your gender and stuff like that. And if you really had to break down, and it's not just, you know, male serial killers, there's also like factors like what was that one movie where it was about that female serial killer? And it was a really big movie. You can cut this
Eileen?
Out, please. Because like, yes,
her name
yes.
Eileen. She's like Absolutely. The only most famous female serial killer. But actually, I kind of have. So I think that serial killers, like, depending on what happened to them in their childhood or in their history, there's different reasons why they kill. Like, let's say there's a male serial killer. He only targets, like, brunettes because his mom is a brunette and she used to abuse him. So there's different, like, reasons. So, like, they all have, like, instances where something that triggers them. And for this case, maybe Huang, he grew up probably with very poor. So he had no money growing up. So then when people are slighting him with money, it triggers him to kill. And this is like a scarcity mindset. And, you know, I'm not surprised because growing up in like the 60s in China, many people are poor growing up. And
so you made the jab that I was going to make on behalf of Willie, because anytime I talk to him about China, he always says F a certain political party. I wanted to say it, but I was like, okay, I don't want to get cyber attacked or something.
And plus, like, if any group is going to kill for money, it's Chinese people, because we like
cut that out.
I can say that I'm Chinese, but you know, like, money.
We did not endorse her message.
Because Chinese people, you know, like, money is very ingrained in our culture. I'm sure you guys have seen that Ronnie Chan, he's a stand-up comedian. He made a segment where, like, everything about the Chinese culture is all about money. Like, it's actually Chinese New Year today. So you give money to each other.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
You're the dragon.
So, yeah. Actually, and then I have a previous coworker. She's from Taiwan. And she told me that, like, you know, so there's like a stereotype that women from Asia, they tend to be gold diggers. And then, you know, maybe more westernized females, they kind of look down on that. They look down on the idea of being gold diggers. However, this coworker who's from Taiwan, she kind of gave me a different perspective. She said that growing up, she was very poor. Like, people in Taiwan are very poor. And the only way to survive is to attach yourself to people with money. And that's why, like, women from Asia, they tend to be more like quote unquote gold digger, because that is how they survive. That is their mindset. But us women, like American women in the West, we are very fortunate. We don't have to go through those hardships. So
say that louder.
Yeah.
Say that louder again. Yeah. Say that louder.
Yeah. Like, as Americans, like, we grew up, we have a pretty abundant lifestyle. So that's why we kind of look down on people, quote unquote, gold diggers, because we don't have to go through those same struggles. So that was just like something she told me that changed my whole perspective. And I am back to serial killers, and that's probably
I like this line. I have to say one thing off of that too, because I think it's fascinating. So anytime my wife and I like watch a documentary about nature, or like we just sometimes we just like to watch those nerdy documentaries where it talks about like primate groups or like the circle of life or whatever, like David Attenborough kind of documentaries, and every time without fail, if there's like a scene where the child animal is being threatened by a predator, my wife is like, oh, like you motherfucker, like, don't do that shit. Like, she gets really upset about it. And I think it's like the same idea. But there was also another documentary portion where they were talking about primates, and like you were kind of saying, Susie, like, sometimes groups within like a primate sect or something will, like, the females, or even not even just the females, the males as well, will attach themselves to the alpha group of the entire collective. And they do that because, like, that's the only way to survive, like, to get enough food for your young, to procreate, like, all that stuff. Like, in that sphere, it's necessary. But it's also kind of interesting that some groups of animals that are different from that, like, they would very much, they would prioritize the nurture of their children, even as a collective. Like, the males would take part in that. You know, they would be very protective. They would be very inclusive of everything. But there are other sects of different animals that, you know, if you fall behind, you're done. You know, you can get the fuck out of my group. And that's kind of scary, isn't it? Like, there are some groups of people who are like that, and there's some groups of people who are not. And like, Americans, maybe like you said, tend to be more protective and inclusive, Whereas yeah. maybe like groups in China, like, you know, they might experience something more similar or indicative of being left behind if they don't try to keep up in a certain capacity. And that's that to me, that's terrifying. Like, I also like I was just laying in the bed the other day with my wife, and this is going to sound really stupid as shit, but like we're, you know, to Disney, but like we were just thinking about like how fucking lucky are we to live in this time period. I was like, look at that TV we have on our wall. That's, you know, that's a TV that we can stream, you know, hundreds of hours of awesome entertainment. We can go downstairs to our refrigerator with cold water and cold food that preserves for a long time. We can literally order out like to any restaurant we want with all kinds. Just, it's just like how lucky are we to live in this time period in this place? And then it just really puts things into perspective. Whereas you have like situations like this family, to tie it back to the story, you know, the family, they weren't struggling. Like you said, they had a really successful business. They worked really hard, yet they felt like it wasn't enough. And I think that's also part of the culture as well. Like, you see people around you in Macau, ultra rich, money's swirling around. There's people driving fancy cars. They have multiple homes and lofts and all kinds of stuff. So therefore, they think they're inadequate. They don't have enough for their family. So they have to do this gambling thing to feel like they're fulfilling more or getting towards closer towards that fulfillment of life. But it ends up biting them in the ass because that's not the environment. That's not the way to achieve that in the environment that they're in.
What's crazy with that family is that they actually had a path forward. They had a freaking successful restaurant business. And if your food is good, like word of mouth spreads, they yeah. have the opportunity to grow even more. Like, they went from a yeah. stand in a fucking alley or whatever to mm-hmm. an actual establishment. And it's a shame that, like, this goes to show, like, how these addictive things just can fucking ruin everything.
Can I just say real quick that that's really, that reminds me of like a situation today where, like, let's say you have someone who got really lucky getting a lump of money, and instead of applying themselves to finding ways to invest that money smartly or investing in themselves or getting a certificate or something or opening a business, they'll sit there and play with 0 days to expiration options on the stock market or something, like throwing all of their money in to try to get rich quick. And it's like, you had two options, just like this family, like you had two options. You can either go to the gambling table and you could try to get rich quick, or you can take that chunk of money you had for gambling and the time that it took to gamble and open up another location and hire a manager for that other location. Or, you know what I mean? Like, there's, it's different ways to look at it. So kind of with Susie on this, where like they didn't deserve to die the way they did, but they were definitely not in the vein of life that they could have been. They could have maximized their potential.
It's also hard to escape the gambling scene when you're in Macau. And
have you been there?
No, I'm not. No. But it just, you know, it just sounds like, I'm sure it's like living in the Strip of Vegas.
Yeah.
Imagine.
You don't have to game.
Yes.
All right, Dean, we're going to Macau, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to put everything on 7 Black.
Maybe you guys
Dude,
can.
I lost $5,000 once at, I think it was like a bunch of slot machines in Florida. I was just like I never gambled it. I never gambled in my entire life. I'm like, I'm going to go to this casino because I've never done this before. I just want to have fun and try it. And here's the chunk of money I had. I thought for sure I was going to walk away with like at least some left over, but I had like a budget of a $5,000 and I lost all of it. So,
dude, my budget would be $5. Like, like, bro, like,
you can play for, you can have half a game. Dude, some of those slot machines, like you can put in a $500 bill. And if you lose, like you lose that $500. Like some, I like in the back room in some like gambling shops, the minimum bet for just one round is $5,000 per bet.
I like how you know all of this.
$10,000. And I've been to a casino twice.
Is there something?
I went twice. I'm just really perceptive. That's all. I've only been twice. Don't give me
slot
shit.
Slot machine is like the worst. Like the worst it chances.
It is. Yeah.
Blackjack's my game.
Blackjack. Yes. That's fun.
That's fun.
Dude, I lost $20 on a sports bet parlay that would have landed me 200K if it actually the last like
$20?
Yeah.
$20 and 200K. Holy shit.
Yeah, I picked like a 10 leg parlay and like it missed by one.
Oh,
and I got so fucking mad. I was like, I'm never doing this shit again. Never doing this shit again.
Well, I don't know, man. If I was you, if I got that close, you got some kind of system a little bit.
Dude, I'm half Indian. I don't like losing money like that. It kills me inside.
I don't think anybody likes losing money.
Apparently, Mr. $5,000 on slots over here.
I kind of liked it. It was, you know,
it was S&M. Fun. It was fun.
Yeah. Well, actually, my husband said one summer he went to Vegas and he lost $25,000.
Oh my God.
That was way before he met me, though. And I'm like, we could have been living so much better right now. But no. But, could have invested that.
We kind of went down like a psychological rabbit hole, a philosophical rabbit hole. Now let's tie it back to this case of the murders.
Right.
So they found the body parts. Due to relatives saying like, hey, they're missing, we don't know where they are, they kind of put two and two together that this restaurant is running, this family owns the restaurant, but there's this random dude that we don't know that's running the restaurant. So eventually he got arrested. First, police grew suspicious because they searched his bank holdings and they found like documents that belonged to the family. And he attempted to flee to mainland China, but then he was captured on September 28th of 1986, and they convicted him of 10 counts of murder on October 2nd. So that's a pretty quick turnaround. So it was like, what, 4 days?
Oh, so no, like, that was 1 year. Actually, I think we forgot an important detail too. On the day that he killed people, there was actually, because 10 people normally operate the restaurant, there was 9 that day. So Zhang's sister, she was not at the restaurant.
Oh.
But then after he killed the 9 people, he knows that she exists. She's a loose end. So he actually told her to come to the restaurant and then he killed her. Which like, oh my God, she is like, she's totally innocent.
She had nothing to do with it.
I know, that's like the... Also the tragic part on top of their children.
Yeah. So they catch him. Yes. And I think in a span of like maybe a week or so, they convict him of 10 counts of murder. And the fact that he kept running the restaurant, we get the urban legend that he baked the victims into pork buns. And that's where we get the name of the pork bun murders.
I thought that was an interesting aspect of the story, because like I, like you, like both of you, I didn't really have a lot of depth of knowledge in this before learning about it, but I just hearing the title, I just assumed, like my mom asked me this morning, she's like, oh, what's your podcast gonna be on today? And then I kind of like told her a brief synopsis of what I understood about the situation, and of course I was completely wrong, because in my mind I thought this guy like immediately turned the family into pork buns and like immediately started feeding them to people. And I'm like, that's the darkest shit you could possibly imagine. It's still dark, but like you just said, Chris, it's all urban legend. Like, you know, I guess he could have, you know, maybe he probably didn't, but I guess he could have been like, oh, I saved a little bit of meat. Let me just be super snarky and put some meat in this bun and serve it to somebody.
Cost effective.
But, yeah, cost effective. But at the same time, it's like, he probably didn't do that. Like that would take too much effort and too much risk of making people sick from eating human flesh, which I imagine is a thing. But at the same time, is it? I don't know. I guess it depends on how you cook it.
I mean, I heard that.
You sound like you have some experience. You have some experience, Susie.
No, I just like, I've heard that it's human meat is a lot like pork. And so mixing it with pork bun, yeah, wouldn't be so.
I've heard that too.
Yeah.
So Chris actually gave me shit because we talked about the Kobe killer, and I went to Kobe at one point and tried Wagyu, and I said the same thing. I'm like, oh, I've heard humans taste a lot like pork. And then Chris is like, you got something to tell us, Dean? I'm like, no. If I ever found out I ate human flesh, I'm getting nauseous just thinking about it. I'd probably throw up everywhere. So what's your takes on this? Do you what's the likelihood, do you think, that he actually turned people into pork buns.
I think it could have. I wouldn't be surprised if he did, because it probably would have been easier for him to clean, dispose. Like, true. Probably he you know, did the disposing on the middle of the night, and then he cut off the limbs, and only the limbs were found on the beach. So, like, the bodies, so he probably, like, he doesn't know what to do with the rest and just throw it into the grinder. And I know I'm kind of talking about it very nonchalantly, but it is very disturbing. And I wouldn't be surprised if he did it.
I can see that now, too. Like, yeah, if he had the torsos left over or other body parts that he just did not have the strength or knowledge to get rid of them, why not just throw them in the grinder? So I don't know. It depends on the depth of madness that he reached at that point, because I imagine killing 10 people is going to fuck with anybody's psyche. So maybe he really did snap at that point. He's just like, you know what? Let me just get rid of these bodies this way, and I'll make some money back off of them.
And I was telling y'all earlier that I've always wanted to try pork buns. I've never had one. And now I don't think I want to.
They're good, though. Do it, man.
I'm sure.
And then I was saying earlier, there's like many, I think there's a very famous Chinese movie about like a woman who ate dumplings filled with fetuses to stay young. And I'm pretty sure that was inspired by this case. So there's definitely a fascination of cannibalism there.
Chris, we talked about this too, like briefly. We can just kind of talk about this for a second before we break off too much off on a tangent. But this whole idea that there's some cabal or some like group of individuals out there who consume the flesh of young or the blood of young to stay youthful. And it's kind of like, where did we get that idea from? It's just kind of like the flawed human psyche. It's like, oh, young people's body plus death plus me equals me being young. Like, I don't, okay, what? That's some specious reasoning right there.
Isn't it like a real thing when they do like a heart transplant, like an older person gets a transplant and they get a heart of like a younger person, they kind of get like a little more invigorated or something?
But not for long, though. Not for long. I think the rest of the body still, you would have to kill a lot of, or you'd have to consume a lot of fetuses to stay continuously young. It's always like in the movies, like, oh, under the next blood moon, I need to shed the life of two virgins and then I'll be good for another 30 years. And it's like, no, like you'd probably have to do that shit every other week to stay as youthful.
It's a conspiracy theory until it's true.
Right? Yeah, right. I like your answer better, because if I think too much about my answer, then I go crazy.
But I love conspiracy theories too.
Oh, yeah. That's great. We haven't really tackled many of them on the show.
We should do that. Yeah, we should bring Susie back and do some conspiracy theories.
If we haven't traumatized her yet.
If we haven't ruined her.
Not at all.
But to wrap up the story that we're covering today. So he does get sent to prison. While he's in prison, the day after he gets convicted, another prisoner beats the crap out of him. He gets sent to the hospital. He attempted to escape from the hospital. On October 6th, he ended up confessing in full detail about how he killed the family. He attempted to kill himself twice.
Oh, shit.
First one, unsuccessful. The second time, he was successful by cutting his wrist with the top of, like, a can, whatever. And his suicide note, which I found to be really fucking weird, that he committed suicide not to escape his crimes, but to escape chronic asthma.
What?
Yeah.
The fuck?
Like, what the fuck? He like, okay, I'm gonna, yeah, I'm having trouble breathing. I don't want to use an inhaler anymore, so I'm just gonna cut my wrists here and call it a day. Yeah, sure. Likely story, buddy.
But wants it to be known that he doesn't regret his crimes.
Yeah, probably.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant. I think you're right on.
He's like, I do not give a fuck, and I don't want to be here anymore. After he died, they were able to take what was left of his fingerprints and link him to the murder in Hong Kong. So two things came out of that. The remains of the family, they were recovered and they were cremated and they were scattered. The ashes were scattered off the coast of Macau by their relatives. So after the arrest, the restaurant was closed and seized by police. In 1987, it was sold to different owners and it's been sold a few times. But as of today, the former restaurant and the apartments above it are a part of the Ba Xiang Hotel. It's Baxian. So I don't know if I said that correctly.
Ba Xiang.
Ba Xiang. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
that's eight in mortal. That means that.
Really?
Oh, sneaky buttholes.
Is that what that means?
Yeah.
Trying to capitalize on the murders. On the
oh my God.
Oh wow. Like they didn't even bother to change the name. That is so weird. Cause
it's all about money.
I guess it's like a tourist attraction now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dude, oh my God. Sorry, man. I just like that's God damn it. Like that's the shitty world. Like our world is beautiful, but it's also shitty. It's like we have people who will turn that into a sideshow. But you know, at the same time, you can have beautiful moments where like, you know, you do reflection on stuff and I don't know. Sorry, I'm just being an idiot digressing.
No, not at all.
That's all good, buddy. But Susie, I did want to ask you, like, given they named that hotel, the Eight Immortals, from the cultures, like the Chinese cultural perspective, are there any superstitions the same that we have in the Western world and in Christianity that there are people that could be possessed by spirits or something to commit these murders? And is there a concept of you don't name a location after something heinous that was committed? I don't know if that made sense of what I'm trying to ask.
Well, Chinese people, well, Asians are very superstitious. So there has got to be some superstitions around that. But like eight is obviously a lucky number in Chinese.
Okay.
And yeah, and then immortal is like the gods, like, so even the name of the restaurant is like all about like wealth, fortune and gods. So I don't know if that answered your question, but there's definitely a lot of superstitions around like, you know, like death and killing and bad luck. Yeah. So the fact that they kept the name is very like bizarre to me because we're very afraid of like bad luck and these and bad superstitions and bad omen. And so I guess it's all just for the tourist attraction.
This is purely just me being curious, but like, what do you have any like spiritual or religious beliefs, Susie? Like, were you raised a certain way or are you kind of agnostic or do you have any like traditional perspectives on things?
Yes. Yeah, so my parents, we practice Buddhism, but we are not hardcore religious. We kind of just practice it on special holidays like today, Chinese New Year. But my parents wouldn't, we never like went to temples or anything like that. Yeah.
Do you believe in like spiritual side, like ghosts and stuff like that?
You know, I want to believe it. Like I actually want to believe there's a life or there's something that happens after we're dead. I don't want to believe that we're just gone. So,
yeah.
And there seems to be a lot of, you know, stories, supernatural stories, paranormal that, would suggest that there is. And yeah, so I want to believe it. And I do believe that there is like another spiritual world out there, life after death.
Yeah.
I have to ask, do you know of any stories your family shared with you or something you've experienced yourself that would make you want to believe?
Yes. So when I was about 12 or 13 years old, my grandmother passed away. So we were at her funeral and it was an open casket. And we were taking turns going up to pay our final respects. And then as I was approaching her casket, I started to smell something very like very distinct and a smell that I've never smelled before. It was like very metallic-y and yeah, so it just kind of lingered a little bit, but it went away. And then 2 days after the funeral, I woke up in my room in the morning and I smelled that same exact smell, like that same metallic-y smell. Like I said, I've never smelled it before.
Yeah.
So I'm like, what are the chances I smell it again?
Yeah.
And then it kind of makes sense that, like, you know, 2 days later, maybe my grandmother is kind of like making her final rounds, like to her family. And, you know, it makes sense that it's 2 days later because I'm like one of her younger granddaughters. So it took time.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's so beautiful.
I know. So ever since that, I do believe that there's got to be like when a person passes, they make one final round to their family. And I've never smelled it again. Otherwise, I'm pretty sure I would remember. It would trigger that, like, that sense.
That's awesome. I love stories like that. That's kind of like stories where you hear people who lost a loved one who had like a favorite bird or something, and like the bird like comes and lands on their windowsill the next day or something like that. Like, it's just,
yeah.
Cause Chris and I like are us idiots like deal with like the worst dark shit you could probably imagine when it comes to stuff like that. We talk about like demonology, you know? But I personally, even though it's like not as interesting to people who listen to these stories, I think I personally like the stories like yours better, where it's, you know, like a family who's like a loved one coming back to visit. That's way better to me.
Yeah, mine are like, what the fuck?
Getting your aunt shoved back into a bathroom door.
Yeah, yeah, I've seen some shit. I've heard some shit. It's not pleasant, which I'll ask another question and... It's okay. Like, you don't have to make up an answer. If you don't have an answer, you don't have an answer.
Or we'll cut it out. Yeah.
Yeah, or we'll cut it out. Were there any topics of discussion with religion and spirits and stuff that were kind of taboo? So for me, it was like, you don't talk about the devil. You don't talk about Satan. You don't talk about demons in the house, because there's the belief that if you talk about it, it gives it power and then you welcome it in. Based on your like upbringing, was that ever a thing?
I would just say that my mom she was always very superstitious. She always liked to wear red because she thinks it's good luck. She'll never wear black. And she just doesn't like to talk about death. So even if there's like death on the TV, like there's a funeral on the TV, she would fast forward it. She doesn't want that kind of energy in the household. And that's as far as like taboo goes. There's nothing, but I find that all like kind of reasonable. Like, she doesn't want to look at death, and that's just how I grew up.
Susie, we want to thank you for being our guest today for your first podcast.
Oh,
you wouldn't be able to tell that this was your first go round on a podcast.
Oh,
you were awesome. So we hope that you do start up your own podcast, and if you ever have guests on, we would love to be on. Look at me inviting ourselves on there.
Yeah. My non-existent podcast.
Your non-existent podcast.
Yes.
You came up with a pretty good name before for it. So I hope you actually keep that. It was,
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would love to. And oh my God, it's so much fun. And I'm so glad that there's other people I can talk like true crime with, because like I said, I can't talk about that with my husband. He doesn't like this stuff. Yeah. Yeah, so I always felt like I'm like, am I crazy? Why do I like this stuff?
No, you're not crazy.
No, I
think that like, it's just, there's so many reasons why you can find it interesting. And the next time we do this true crime stuff, bring your husband on. We'll make him a believer of it. We'll get a four-parter going, and he can sit there awkwardly and we can just talk.
He doesn't like scary stuff. Like, I used to watch, I used to love scary movies, but because he doesn't watch it, like, I kind of stopped watching it, and now I'm scared.
What?
I feel like you need
to watch it when
you need
asleep.
A tolerance. You need to build a tolerance to these things, and then once you stop watching it, you get scared. You start to get scared again.
When my wife goes to sleep, I'll like put on scary stuff, or when she's not home. We have, is it HBO Max or what the hell they call themselves now? Max. And they have like a section dedicated to like paranormal, ghosts, true crime. And that's what I'll put on all day. Like, if she's not home, I'll
watch
that crap.
I have to beg my wife to watch horror movies now. Like, okay. Please, like, listen.
So I guess, like, this is our outlet. This is our outlet for, like,
exactly
our love for scary things.
We're the outliers of society. We're the degenerates of the media world. Like, everybody likes to watch happy movies and like funny shit. We just want to watch scary, mysterious stuff.
No, but
we're the goth kids.
We're the goth kids.
There's definitely a market for it, because like the Mr. Ball, and he has like 9 million subscribers. So there's definitely a lot of people who love this stuff.
Yeah.
You're going to hit the Mr. Ballin levels.
I wish. Yeah.
We're all going to make it, and then we're going to have this one big ass studio, and
this will be the full-time production job.
Yeah, absolutely. But Susie, why don't you tell the listeners of where they could find you?
Yeah, so I'm on YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, but I just post very casually. So it's all Susie Ideally, SusieIdeally. You'll find like mom, baby, cutesy content.
Nice.
So you heard that, folks. Go ahead and subscribe to her stuff. Her content is awesome. And when she comes out with her podcast, give her a follow as well.
Yes.
And with that, always remember, rag on the hag and check your pork buns before you eat them.
All right. Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you for tuning into today's episode of The Wandering Road. If you enjoyed today's episode, please give us a rating on Apple, Google, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And please share the show with your friends, as that would help us grow immensely. Also, be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on TikTok at TWR Podcast, our Instagram at TW Road Podcast, and our Facebook by searching for The Wandering Road Podcast. If you'd like to get a hold of us, you can reach us at our email address, twroadpodcast@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. We would love to have you on the show as a guest so you can share your stories, or you could submit email submissions of your stories that we could dedicate an episode to. Thanks, and we'll catch you on the next one.